4. The guards were waiting for them in the hall. Cal had gotten the prince all the way back to the palace and up the basin steps before running into the men. Two of them Rai's, the other two his, and all four looking put out.
"Peace, Tolnus," said Kel, feigning lightness. "Want to give me a hand?"
As if he were carrying a sack of wheat and not the royal prince of Arnes. Rai's guards looked pale with anger and worry, but neither stepped forward.
"Staff? Hostra?"
he said, appealing to his own men. He was met with stony silence.
"Fine. Get out of my way, I'll carry him myself."
He pushed past the guards.
"Is that the prince's blood?"
asked Vis, pointing at Kel's sleeve, which he'd used to wipe Rai's face clean.
"No," he lied, "only mine."
Rai's men relaxed considerably at that, which Kel found disconcerting. Vis was a nervous sort, hackles always raised, and Tolnus was utterly humorless, with the set jaw of an officer. They had both served King Maxim himself before being assigned to guard the young royal, and they took the prince's defiance with far less nonchalance than Rai's previous men. As for Kel's own guards, Hostra was young and eager, but Staff hardly ever said a word, either to Kel's face or in his company. For the first month, Kel hadn't been sure if the guard hated him or feared him or both. Then Rai told him the truth, that Staff's sister had died in the Black Night, so Kel knew that it was likely both.
"He's a good guard," said Rai when Kel asked why they would assign him such a man, and then added grimly, "It was father's choice."
Now, as the party reached the royal hall the brothers shared, Tolnus produced a note and held it up for Kel to read.
"This isn't funny."
Apparently, Rai had had the grace to pin the note to his door in case anyone in the palace should worry. "Not kidnapped. Out for a drink with Kel. Sit tight." Rai's room was at the end of the hall, marked by two ornate doors. Kel kicked them open.
"Too loud,"
murmured Rai.
"Master Kel," warned Vis, following him in, "I must insist you cease these—"
"I didn't force him out. But you allowed—"
"I'm his brother, not his guard,"
snapped Kel. He knew he'd been raised as Rai's protection as much as his companion, but it was proving no small task. And besides, hadn't he done enough? Tolnus scowled.
"The king and queen—"
"Go away," said Rai, rousing himself. "Giving me a headache."
"Your highness," started Vis, reaching for Rai's arm.
"Out!"
snapped the prince with sudden heat. The guards shied away, then looked uncertainly at Kel.
"You heard the prince," he grumbled. "Get out."
His gaze went to his own men.
"All of you."
As the doors closed behind him, Kel half-guided, half-dragged Rai into his bed.
"I think I'm growing on them," he muttered.
Rai rolled groggily onto his back, an arm cast over his eyes.
"I'm sorry. Sorry,"
he said softly, and Kel shuddered, remembering that horrific night, the prince bleeding to death as he and Lila tried to drag him to safety, the soft "I'm sorry's" fading horribly into silence and stillness, and
"all my fault."
Rai's voice dragged him back. "Hush," said Kel, sinking into a chair beside the bed.
"I just wanted, like it was before."
"I know," said Kel, rubbing his eyes. "I know." He sat there until Rai fell quiet, safely wrapped in sleep, and then pushed himself back to his feet. The room rocked faintly, and Kel steadied himself for a moment on the carved bedpost before making his way back to his own rooms. Not via the hall and its contingent of guards, but the hidden corridor that ran between their chambers. The lanterns burned to life as Kel entered, the magic easy, effortless. But the light didn't make the room feel more like home. The space had always felt strangely foreign, stiff, like an ill-fitting suit. It was a room for a royal. The ceiling was lined with billowing fabric, the colors of night, and an elegant desk hugged one wall. A sofa and chairs huddled around a silver tea set, and a pair of glass doors led onto a balcony now coated with a thin layer of snow.
Kel shrugged off his coat and turned it inside out a few times, returning it to its royal red before draping it over an ottoman. Kel missed his little room at the top of the stairs in the Ruby Fields, with its rough walls and its stiff cot and its constant noise. But the room in the inn and the woman who ran it had all been burned to nothing by Holland months before, and Kel could not bring himself to seek out another. The room had been a secret, and Kel had promised the Crown and Rye that he would stop keeping secrets. He missed the room and the privacy that came with it, but there was something to the missing. He supposed he deserved it. Others had lost far more because of him. So Kel remained in the royal chambers. The bed waited on a raised platform, a plush mattress with a sea of pillows, but Kel slumped down into his favorite chair instead. A battered thing, by comparison, dragged from one of the palace's studies, it faced the balcony doors and, beyond, the warm red glow of the aisle. He snapped his fingers, and the lanterns dimmed and then went dark. Sitting there with only the river's light, his tired mind drifted, as it invariably did, back to Delilah Bard. When Kel thought of her, she was not one girl, but three. The too skinny street thief who'd robbed him in an alley, the blood-streaked partner who'd fought beside him, and the impossible girl who'd walked away and never looked back. "Where are you, Lila?" he mused. "And what kind of trouble are you getting into?" Kel dragged a kerchief from his back pocket, a small square of dark fabric first given to him by a girl dressed as a boy in a darkened alley, a sleight of hand so she could rob him. He'd used it to find her more than once, and he'd wondered if he could do it again, or if it now belonged more to him than to her. He wondered where it would take him if it worked. He knew, with a bone-deep certainty, that she was alive, had to be alive, and he envied her. Envied the fact that this gray London girl was out there somewhere seeing parts of the world that Kel, a red Londoner, an Antari, had never glimpsed. He put the kerchief away, closed his eyes, and waited for sleep to drag him under. When it did, he dreamed of her. Dreamed of her standing on his balcony, goading him to come out and play. He dreamed of her hand tangling in his, a pulse of power, twining them together. He dreamed of them racing through foreign streets, not the London ones they'd navigated, but crooks and bends in places he'd never been, and ones he might never see. But there she was, at his side, pulling him toward freedom.